Before we start today's podcast, I want to encourage you to go to dogbehaviorconference.com and check out this year's Dog Behavior Conference. It's a three-day live online event available to anyone around the world who loves dogs and wants to live their best life together with them. Registration is open now and seats are going fast, so visit dogbehaviorconference.com and reserve your spot today. That's dogbehaviorconference.com. Now, let's get to the podcast. Back by popular demand. Every year, Andy Hale now comes and speaks at the conference. Why? Because we love him. Why? Because when people hear what he has to say, their lives, their relationships change with their dogs. And I absolutely love having him on the podcast. I love having him as part of the Dog Behavior Conference. He is talking about cake, which is one of my favorite things to eat. But this is not the kind of cake you're thinking of. It is a cake acronym, and it stands for compassion, awareness, knowledge, and empathy. And so I am dying to ask you, Andrew, all about this, about bringing cake to dog training. Well, first of all, welcome to the podcast again. I'm so glad you're here.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always good to have a natter with you.
Yes, we love our natters, so we put the world to rights. Now, this I've never heard of cake before, so can you take us through it?
Well, I think I can. I just want to say, you know, Victoria, I think this will be my fourth year at the conference. And I feel like we need to bring out a bit of an Andy box set, really, now, because they all kind of built and linked in. And,
yes.
And this year is going to be the same. And it's been amazing to have that safe space with you, actually, to ask some questions, because and that's what we're doing, I think. You know, I get a lot of people, because of some of the things I talk about, question whether I think training's a good thing. Is training good? Is training bad? Training is in its essence neutral. It's neutral, isn't it? It's not good or bad. I think definitely the moving away from aversive means to positive means has been a really powerful thing for us. But this is about us standing on that and asking more questions about what do we do. And when you think about what we do as dog trainers, as dog behavioral professionals, our job is literally to turn up to the behavior of another living sentient being, to consider creating it, changing it, controlling, whatever you want to think about. And I think that's what the questions are, and that's what we've been asking at these conferences over the last few years, actually. And I think it's really important, and I love how things have adapted even within VSA, things like the harmony model, all these kind of things, like what do we do with this? How do we think about it? So this is what cake is about, really, because I've got a little mantra, which I'm going to talk about at the conference. I'm not going to give away too much now, which is learn, support, teach. Learn from the dog first, support what you've learnt, and teach things that you feel are likely to be intrinsically valuable for that dog. After that, train what you like. I think this is the key. Because traditionally it's been the other way around, isn't it?
Yes, you know, it has.
We do it. So cake is about understanding that. Now, we all love cake, right? So it's brilliant that it happens to spell cake. And we're going to look in the conference at going through those four words and why they're so important. And also look at the things that make it difficult, actually. Because it's our brains are kind of designed to have a bit of a bias towards wanting to change the behavior in another to fit our own worldview, our own safe worldview, our own narratives. As I say, we're kind of designed to be like that. So we have to understand the things that might stop us from thinking, okay, I might think that I know what's best for Victoria. I think if only Victoria would behave like this, she would be happy, she would feel safe, she would whatever. But actually the reality is, if I don't ask you, if I don't find out a way of getting that feedback, then I am just getting you to do stuff based on my narratives. So that's why those four words are really important. Compassion is where we always start. Now, and it allows us to turn up regardless of our judgments. You know, being compassionate is not about being, it's not about condoning. It's not about approving of. It's about turning up anyway, regardless of what you're doing. So this is really important for us as dog trainers. When we think about turning up to support that caregiver who might be using tools and methods that our more judgy brain, we're going to look at all this at the conference, might be wanting to make some little judgment calls about. And remember, our brain is designed to judge, and that's absolutely fine. But we can learn to change our relationship with that judgment and not let it drive our response. And that's also the same when we work for, with a dog, actually. It's just giving ourselves think, right, what is the individual lived emotional experience of that person or that dog that I'm here to support? And compassion allows us to turn up anyway. I'm going to turn up anyway. Awareness is about learning how to be better at navigating our own biases so we can try and be as aware as we can be of the other's lived experience. knowledge, of course, we bring knowledge. But actually, that should come secondary to seeking knowledge from the caregiver and from the dog especially. I've got some beautiful footage I'm going to be showing of my little 16-week-old pup teaching me loads of stuff. Teaching me loads of stuff at 16 weeks. And then when you have compassion, awareness and knowledge, you're more likely to be able to have empathy. Now, the amazing Brené Brown says, empathy fuels connection. She also goes on to say, actually, sympathy drives disconnection. And I find that really interesting because actually sympathy does provide a bit of a power imbalance if you think about it. You know, I sympathize with you, but there's often a but. Empathy is about, for me, truly turning up to the lived experience of another and feeling it like it was your own. We're also going to talk about making sure that we as professionals recognize that we're not responsible for it, though, because that's very important. But that means that when we think about empathy, the action that empathy should be providing is that we want to do what we can, the best we can do to support that lived experience that we are now involved with. Making sure that, for example, if you're having a trauma-informed approach, that you're not creating more trauma. If you're working with that dog or the human counterpart, something we talked about last year, the importance of social and emotional safety, making sure that what we're doing is supporting those safety needs. Because even with reinforcement, and this is something we talked about right in that first conference I did with you, is just recognizing the coercive potential in reinforcement, just recognizing that just because we can get another behavior doesn't mean necessarily that the dog feels any safer or that they're doing this kind of thing. So that's why CAKE's important. And I've got another little acronym that goes with CAKE, which we're going to talk about, which is tea, because us Brits, we love tea.
Yeah.
I prefer coffee, but I couldn't think of the right words for coffee.
Tea's great.
So tea goes with CAKE. So CAKE, what I love about CAKE is, and I talk about CAKE a lot, you know, I talk about CAKE when I was talking at a thing before Christmas for vets. I think it's not a bad thing to bring to any new relationship, or especially if we're going to turn up in a supportive role, is to bring CAKE and to understand what CAKE is. And also to give CAKE to ourselves, to give ourselves compassion. You know, self-compassion is really important because we're lacking in it often as dog trainers. And when I hear about people having compassion fatigue, for example, you know, that's a clear sign for to me anyway that they're lacking in self-compassion first, I think. So CAKE, so tea goes with CAKE. So tea, the T in tea is time. So if I'm going to turn up to hear the story of the caregiver about their own trials and tribulations of looking after this dog, or if I'm going to turn up to that dog and try and learn some of their story, I want to give the time that they need to do that. And that's where the E comes in, because the E is encourage, and encourage them to tell that story. Encourage that dog to tell the story. I see behavior as the dog trying to paint a picture. And I want that dog to paint that picture. One of the problems we've had, I think, or still have to a point, is that we keep grabbing the brush all the time to kind of say that we can paint it better for you. the dog can paint the picture perfectly well for us if we give them time and we encourage them to paint the picture. And the same for the caregiver. You know, we don't want to be stopping them in telling us their story just because they're getting the words wrong, you know, based on our positive vocabulary. So that's the E. And then the A is to acknowledge what we've learned. So we come with cake, we give time then, we encourage a story to be told, and we acknowledge, we bear witness to what we've learned, regardless of our own judgments and our own expectations, you know. And I think as professionals, we have to be more open to that. I totally understand the temptation to think, you know, I think it's just a bit easier just to turn up and give you a training plan and whatever else. But I think we're now understanding, and especially the conversations that you and I have had, that we need to do better, actually, for the general public and their doggies. I think we need to elevate our conversation away from just looking at doing task, because that's that operant merry-go-round that we talked about in my first talk, because, you know, all those diversive and balanced style trainers, a lot of their language, we need to do better with what we talk about. Because if the general public start thinking more in terms of emotional well-being and a care approach, we'll look at this a little bit in the talk, at the conference, the shift from task to care, then actually we don't have to have those discussions and arguments about methods and tools, because the general public will think, well, I understand now about more about my dog. And one final point here, we've got this crazy time, Victoria, it's a crazy time, where we've never known more about the dog's individual lived experience. What's amazing about the VSA platform, and any of the VSA and VSPDT trainers know this, is that, you know, the education that's given there is broad. You know, with people like Sarah Fisher and Sarah Heath and others talking about a broad spectrum of things, keeping us on the ball with the very latest in science and understanding about the beautiful, rich lives of these amazing animals. So we've never known more, yet the general public have never been more detached from that information. And it's getting worse, isn't it, Victoria? Oh my God, because of it's become the Wild West now on social media. So we've got to let the general public know why just getting the task done isn't enough. And the problem with the task approach is, so task just means that transactional, you know, we're going to get the dog to stop barking, stop pulling, we're going to get the dog to do or not do something as our own objective. If the task can't be done, somebody has to be to blame. And often people feel that blame. Either the dog's not good enough, the caregiver's not doing it right, or sadly, a lot of dog trainers feel they're not good enough. But they're swimming upstream with that task because there's a little very simple question. Is the dog able to do it? And if not, why? I think that's the key. So a care approach just means learning from the other first. So it brings me right back to what I said at the beginning. Learn, support, teach is the mantra I want to put across and unpack as part of that cake at the conference.
Okay. I have a gazillion questions. First of all, my reaction to that is just, you're extraordinary, because you are extraordinary. And I am so excited for people to learn from you with this. But the first question that comes to me is what you said about judgment. Like, we don't want to rush to judgment, do we? But in fact, judgment isn't that important for our survival. Isn't our ability to judge important for that, for us to make a good decision?
Ah, I love what you said there. To make a good decision. Now, this is, we're going to look at this a little bit. So the first part of the conference chat, we're going to touch a little bit on judgments because they're important for us. So the brain, when we get to adulthood especially, the brain has created this safe worldview. We have our belief systems, our value systems, and it doesn't want to have to reappraise that very much. So we have cognitive appraisals. And that's why there's two things about us humans that is very true. I'm laughing only because I was talking to my husband about this earlier and he told me this story, which I won't share on air, but anyway, I'll perhaps share with you later. Anyway, that's really awful for the listeners. Maybe if we do a late night version, I'll share that story, because it's quite a funny one. But two things about us humans. One is we do love to judge. We're designed to judge. Now, this is the problem, though. The second thing for us that's true of us as a species is we hate to be judged. And this is the thing. So we are literally designed to judge. So the brain wants to make cognitive appraisals. These are quick thinking, instant judgments based on very, very thin information often for our survival, because we don't want to really have to think reappraising everything. The brain's like, well, I've already kind of made my mind up about that. And this is why we get such polarized views with politics and all this kind of thing, because especially, as I say, when we get to a certain point in our life, our brain wants to protect those kind of value systems and belief systems. And that's why we have cognitive biases and cognitive distortions and all those kind of belief filters that information comes in. And that's why you can say one thing to somebody and they will hear something very different because of their own biases. So you're absolutely right. It is part of our survival thing, because the brain doesn't want to have to reappraise. It wants to just make those instant judgments. So for everyday life, that's fine. And what can happen is we can end up not questioning those judgments and having those instant judgments with very little information or fact drive our response. And one thing we need to be better at, and especially one of the kind of golden rules for human therapists, two things. One is that when you are turning up to support another, you have to be as well regulated as you can be yourself. And secondly, you have to navigate your own biases and your own judgments. And it does take a bit of practice, Victoria, because, as I say, our brain is very quick to judge and make those quick judgments. And without very little things, there's a great little saying in human psychology terms, which is feelings are not facts. And our judgy brain just goes on a quick thinking feeling. And we've got to be careful with that, I think. So we're going to look at this a little bit on the conference, but we can change our relationship with those judgments. We can learn not to let them drive our response. The number of dogs I've worked with where the previous trainer has refused to work with them unless they get rid of a certain tool. You know, it's a very cliff edge thing. I get it to a point, but now that person goes without support and just feels very judged. We've got to meet people where they are and create safety. I'm going to be introducing something called the range of safety in the conference talk, because we all have our physical, emotional and social safety needs. I do as a professional, so does the caregiver, so does the dog. And where we all meet, that's where we need to work. But if we don't create a safe, supportive relationship with the caregiver, it's going to be very hard. And we have the three A's, which I'm also going to talk about at the conference, awareness, acknowledgement, acceptance. And that is how we move people through their judgments and their existing beliefs. So many of our clients, the reason I wanted to touch on this at the beginning of the conference talk is because I think for dog trainers especially, who feel really bad when they're putting a lot of effort with a client and then they find out down the line that they went to the shock jock down the road or they did whatever and they feel personally bad about that, is to recognize we cannot force anybody to feel or think in a certain way. But we can try and create connective relationships and support them through it. So the first day, awareness, we want to support their awareness of their dog's experience. And then we need to support them to acknowledge that. So they probably think when we meet them, oh, my dog's being dominant, my dog's being naughty, my dog's being bad, my dog's being stubborn, whatever it is. And we need to help them be aware, more aware, really, of what their dog's actual lived experience might be. And then they need to acknowledge that. But that's where we have to help them navigate their own biases, their own judgments. And it can be hard sometimes. And not everybody can. And that's because of their own trauma, their own story, their own whatever, really. Sometimes people are so indoctrinated in a certain way of thinking about behavior, especially. One of the first things we did in the first conference that I spoke at was challenge the good, bad continuum, this notion that somehow. So, yeah. And then if we can get them through to the next day, the final A, acceptance. There's a lot of studies for humans that show that when you get to acceptance, it almost unlocks that advocacy part of the brain. You know, once you can truly accept your dog for who they are and what they're experiencing, now you can advocate well for them because you've navigated your own biases. Same for a human, you know. And I think, so that's what we're going to look at on the judgment side of things and why it's so important, especially for us as professionals, to understand the challenges that are there sometimes to persuade somebody to shift that. And it's not ultimately our responsibility. You know, we can't make them.
I'm speaking with the wonderful Andrew Hale. We're going to be back after these messages because I would like to explore a little bit more about good and bad behavior. It's my favorite weekend of the year. Okay, maybe after Thanksgiving and my daughter's birthday. But it really is something I look forward to all year long, the Dog Behavior Conference. It seems like I say this every year, but it really is true. The 2024 lineup of Dog Behavior Conference speakers has me as fired up as I've ever been for what I truly believe is the most meaningful, enlightening, impactful, and inspirational event available to dog geeks like you and me anywhere in the dog world. With speakers including returning favorites like Sarah Fisher, Mike Shikashio, Arit Bloom, Andrew Hale, and Sarah Heath, to newcomers like Robert Hewings, Marty and Mikhail Becker, Lisa and Brad Wagner, and more. The range of topics covered is custom tailored to serve you no matter where you are on your dog journey. A wide-eyed newbie figuring things out for the first time, or a longtime professional trainer or shelter rescue worker looking to fine-tune your skills and knowledge. It seems like everywhere you turn now since COVID, someone is offering yet another online event, course, or conference, promising the latest and greatest in dog training knowledge. But we've been doing this for over a decade, including in-person dog behavior conferences since 2010, to accompany our longtime Victoria Stillwell Academy and Positively.com courses for guardians and pet pros alike. So go to dogbehaviorconference.com now to check out the DBC and secure your seat today. Registration is open and available to you wherever you are in the world. The live event happens from April the 19th to the 21st, but you'll automatically get access to all of the recordings from the conference for 12 months. So it's okay if you can't join us live for some or all of the weekend. The DBC is special, and I'd hate for you to miss it. So visit dogbehaviorconference.com now to get your ticket. That's dogbehaviorconference.com. And now, back to the podcast. I'm back with Andy Hale. Andrew, Andy, I don't know. I call you both.
I'll take both.
So you mentioned the good and bad behavior now. They're labels. We like to label behavior that we see as that we like as good behavior, and behavior that we don't like that could be dangerous or that we don't understand or that's scary for us as bad behavior. And of course, we say, but look, at the end of the day, from the dog, it's just behavior, right? It's our bias that labels it good or bad, or it's our social bias that labels it good or bad. How do we get that message across to people? Because, well, maybe I've got a lot of questions, but first, when you were saying that I agree with you that I think it's never been worse because of the advent of social media, and there's such disconnection now and such misunderstanding. It's almost like social media has been our friend, but it's also an incredible foe because it has caused this disconnection. But how do we navigate all of the misinformation that's out there? How can we navigate that, and as well as advocating for dogs and trying to move people away from that? It almost seems to say that, like, when we're saying about good and bad behavior, well, actually, we're not even there yet because people are just so disconnected. How are we going to even get to that point where we can say, look, it's your judgment of behavior. It's social judgment of behavior, but actually it's just behavior. That's a lot and confusing. Sorry, Andy, but you got me all riled up.
It is a lot. And actually, if we step back from this, this is why I think it's challenging. It isn't a dog thing. It's an us thing. It's an everything thing. And we have to recognise that there are huge societal questions that have to be asked about us as a species. And we're so far off the right track, really, in both in our education system, in our corrective system, in the way that we look at doing things. I'm going to be sharing a little bit about my own story at the conference, because it's I want to talk about how just this notion of just seeing behavior in a very rigid way affects many people, let alone dogs. So it's a big picture. And I think we have to be realistic here. I do think we need to change our approach. We need to sell something, if you like, that is very different to the general public, but that they need to hear something different. They need to definitely hear something different from task. You know, we have to move away from just trying to persuade them to do task nicer. I think we have to think about what a care approach really looks like. You know, my group's called Dog Centre Care, because I've kind of taken that title from our colleagues who are looking at the future of progressive child educational psychology and development, where they have a child-centered care approach. So these are big questions way above our pay grade, Victoria, but it doesn't mean that we can't do our bit and just have these discussions and think about what is it that we need to let the general public know, so when they have that little aha moment, when they turn away from the cul-de-sac that they're stuck in, that allows them to reconnect back to their dog again. Now, some people, it doesn't matter what we say, they're not going to get it, but many people will. And we have to recognise that we're all indoctrinated in that good-bad continuum, that notion that somehow behaviour is good or bad. But as we asked in my first conference speech at the conference, was that sounds right, doesn't it? We want to reward the good and punish or ignore the bad. On our side of the fence, we do the ignore the bad. But until you ask a really simple but fundamental question, who's deciding what's good or bad? And what did that behaviour represent? Now, we need societal norms. We need rule of law. We need social decency. And that's when people often say, oh, yeah, but we've got to have this in place, haven't we? And from a young age, you've got to learn respect, haven't you? And from a young age, you've got to learn to behave, haven't you? Because otherwise it would be a free-for-all. But there's a really simple question, again, we have to ask is, that's fine, but what about the individual's ability to learn that stuff? So for little Johnny, who's in school today, that's an achievement for little Johnny. And it's an achievement because he hasn't had breakfast today. He didn't sleep very well last night. He's traumatised by his family arguing. He's traumatised by physical, emotional, sexual abuse, whatever it is. So that's an achievement for him. But he's now stuck in a system that is based on attainment. Attainment based on what he should learn, but guess what? He can't learn. So his own brain system, a lot of the, when we think about secure attachments, he's already struggling with insecure attachments. When we think about seeking systems in the brain and how they can flip easily into those rage circuits, which is kind of frustration, his behavior is going to change. And now it won't take long before little Johnny will be labeled as disruptive, naughty, bad. I feel very emotional about it because I'm going to be sharing a little bit about my own story at the conference. So this is the thing, you see, it's bigger than just making people behave. So I talked about social safety last year at the conference. I shared a poo story, which got people really thinking about things. I know. And there was a kind of a meta-analysis of several surveys of humans who identified as being socially anxious and having their own social sensitivities, and how many of them pinpointed back to key events when they were in their teens, especially around being forced into social engagement that they felt uncomfortable with, whether that was at school or being made to come down out the bedroom, being made to stay at the dinner table. Now, traditionalists will say, well, you've got to learn this stuff, and that's absolutely fine. But if you've got a nervous system that's screaming, I don't feel safe, what are they actually learning? Again, something we talked about in the second conference that I talked about, the difference between what we are taught and what we learn.
Yes.
Because we might be taught our lesson, in inverted commas, but what are we learning about choice, agency, feeling safe, being able to communicate need and be heard? So boundaries are important. We have to think about that. But they shouldn't be barriers to unmet need. And I think a lot of these dogs that I see, especially the ones who are, you know, not particularly safe to be around, they haven't been heard. They don't feel safe. Many of them, the caregivers have not done anything wrong. They've done all the normal stuff. Well, we went to dog training classes. We, you know, we taught the dog all these things, but the dog's been taught loads of stuff that invariably has little value to them. What the dog has learnt, though, is that when I try and communicate to you need, it's not being addressed because the general public don't know what that. This is the point, Victoria. You know, the general public have been convinced the most important thing is a well-trained, obedient dog. And on our side of the fence, positive training, we have to accept some of the responsibility there. I've been there myself, got in my early career. I was as operant as you like.
Yep, me too.
The general public now are thinking, that, so they know how to teach sit, right? But they don't know what pain looks like. They don't know what stress looks like. They don't know about development stages. They don't understand all these kind of things. So this is why we have to shift, I think, our language. Because if we shift our language, if we shift our focus, then it raises us above what all the usual chatter is about. And the general public will find us. And we have to, this is, we can't, like I said earlier, you can't make everybody think everything, but we can become a beacon. And those that will find us will find us, and then more will find us, and more will find us, and it builds up from there. Because many, many of the general public have done the train more, train more, train more, regardless of the method, and realise that the dog's getting worse potentially, regardless of what method you use, because underneath it, the dog's in pain, or the dog's struggling to cope, or they don't feel safe.
Can you answer this question for me? And maybe it's getting a bit too deep, but I struggle with how people can get away with, think it's okay to hurt dogs, intimidate them, cause them to fear in the name of training. I don't understand why those people are celebrated, but how they get away with it. And what is it in the human psyche that tells them that's okay to do that to a vulnerable being?
But this fits really well when we step back. The notion of the good-bad continuum, how we see behaviour more traditionally, because we used to have, and maybe we still do to a point, children should be seen and not heard. When I was at school, I had the cane.
Oh, yeah, so I got hit too.
Which, when you think about it, Victoria, for anybody under a certain age, yes, we did hit children with sticks. Within living memory, we did used to chain children up only 100 years ago and make them work. You know, I think this is it's a similar kind of mindset. We have women still heavily oppressed around the world, being made to behave in a certain way or else. I mean, this is the key. And a lot of it's about power. A lot of it's about that kind of notion that somebody who has that power, who often is the one who can exert a view of the world on others and make it happen. It's kind of in our DNA a little bit. And I think we're moving forward. I'd like to think in the same way now, most people, especially here in the UK, rightly would be appalled at what we did to children, even 30, 40, 50 years ago. I'd like to think that at some point it will shift and we'll do the same for dogs once we understand that, I think. So it is a deep question, I think. And we have to remove a lot of the intergenerational trauma that keeps perpetuating this. Because I put out a piece recently, going back a while, about shock collars and talking about how any aversive training, people say, well, it's a choice, and I got smacked, it never did me any harm. I had the cane, it never did me any harm. As soon as somebody says that, I think, God, it has done you harm then, because you've now normalized pain. And I think this is what happens. We see these often men, not always, I know, often men on TikTok and others stringing dogs up, yanking them, kicking them, pinning them, whatever. eliciting pain through devices. But because a lot of the people seeing it, they're being lied to. This is the point. The general public are being lied to. They're being gaslit by these people because they are saying to them, yeah, the dog's behaving badly, isn't it? I can show you how I can make your dog not do that and everything will be okay. And that because of that good, bad continuum, it's like, oh my God, look what they can do. And then they also lie by saying, we're the only ones who can save these red zone dogs. We're the only ones who can save these dogs because all the cookie pushers, in inverted commas, they've just failed them. But all this stuff is lies, whether or not they are deliberately lying, I don't know. I think some of them might be, but probably many of them are lying without knowing it because they believe that. Brings us to what we're talking about at the top of the hour. Their belief system, their value system especially, is very different to the reality for the animal. They are just, you know, doing what they say they can do, which is, oh, well, I'll stop them doing that. But we have the same problem with children, don't we? I think some people, you know, where kids are, you know, even... When I first started in, when I was finishing my psychology degree back in the late 80s, early 90s, we still had the remnants of some of the Borstal system here in the UK. It wasn't that long ago that we, you know, the short, sharp shock of often already really disadvantaged, you know, little Johnny types, like I was talking about earlier, who've already been failed by the system. So this is why I think we have to counter this differently in my book. But we can't do the usual ways of doing things. We have to just put out a message that's very different for people to hear, and for people to buy into.
We have to sing with the same voice as well. There's no good in calling yourself a positive trainer if you are not going to be, you know, more of that sort of, I say revolutionary. It is in terms of the way people have always viewed dogs. What you are talking about is revolutionary because it's different, right? It's not what people are used to. But I wish it wasn't, but it is. How do we get buy-in from the positive training community that not only should we be exploring this and moving forward, we should not be attacking members of our own group because I'm saying one thing and you're saying another. And actually, and then both are attacking the punitive trainers because of course they're doing it wrong. How do we come together as an industry, especially with the positive trainers? If the punitive trainers, which of course I'm now putting people in boxes, but I have to generalize it. If the punitive trainers are not going to want to come along with us, they're not going to want to join the revolution, as it were. And sorry to use that word, it's the only word that came to my head to kind of explain it. If they're not, which I understand, but how do we get the positive trainers on the same, like just thinking in the same vein and not dissing each other and not being gross on social media too towards other trainers, whether they are punitive or positive? How do we do that?
Oh God, if I had the answer to that, I'd be thinking we're wrong. I'd like to break that into two bits though. Because I hear what you're saying there. I'm going to deal with the second bit first, which is our community, dog trainers, and how we fall out. And there is what I call the quiet majority who don't. I think it's always worth remembering that.
Yes.
You know, and I've got amazing colleagues that I don't always see eye to eye with. And we can have a bit of a to-do, handbags at dawn, and then we can have a good laugh afterwards. And that's just emotional maturity, I think. I think any community, especially as broad as ours, is going to have different personalities, different people. And I think online as well, a lot of the, you know, I just wonder if people would even talk to each other like that if they were in a room together. I don't know. So I don't think there is an answer to that. I don't think we should worry about that. I think it's always going to be as such. I do think that there is a shift. that is happening. I'm not a big fan of absolutism myself. What I mean by that is, you know, I have colleagues who have a very, very kind of absolute view on certain things. And my late mother used to say there's no absolutes but kindness. And I think for me, if we were to convert that for dogs, it'd be no absolutes but welfare. And I think there's always that kind of grey area on most things. And I think on our, the positive community doesn't like that sometimes, because if you do this, then it must be bad without even knowing the story. But it's, I think, but also, I also recognise actually that some of our colleagues who are a bit absolutist on some things, I see it a little bit like the Paris or Milan fashion show. Who's going to wear that stuff?
Yeah.
Nobody. Maybe my husband. But most of us will wear a version of that when it filters down to the racks and in the shops, you know. So we do kind of need those voices, but they're not the voices we've got to. I'm being a bit clumsy always here, but I think there is a shift. There is a shift happening, which is thinking about the dog, the individual dog in front of us, learning more about that kind of shift from task to care. But it's new, like you say, it's new. And like anything new, I hope that over the years, it might take a decade, who knows, that this will become more of a normal way of thinking. I think we've just got to keep putting these conversations out there. What happens over time, I think, is you have those little nuclei and then more attract and more attract and more attract. Before you know it, you've got a planet. And I think that's what's happening. And this is what's wonderful about the conference, of course, because we have a chance to talk about these things and we keep building these things through. So that's that side of it. Getting our community to get on, I think that's too big a task for anybody. Mm. The second thing, though, is what's really going to make a difference is legislation.
Yep.
that is ultimately where we have to bring people together around that. I've got a bit of an idea of that, which I've shared with you. And when I'm getting back to full Andy, I've been a bit out of sorts recently, but then I'm going to revisit that, because I think we need something that's a really clear international, ideally, line in the sand, really, at which we can evidence base, especially with the science, so that legislators don't have to think about, well, we hear you, but we're also listening to them. I think at some point that is the key to get. It's crazy. What is really crazy for me, and I'm not saying we shouldn't have these other rights, but, you know, we've got international conventions on crustaceans, international conventions on whaling. These are things that are important. International conventions on farming. These are really important, because without that, we wouldn't have the better welfare. And yet we have nothing for the dog. If I had a pig in my back garden here in the UK, I would be under way more oversight than having a dog. So something isn't right. So we've got to think about legislation. Ultimately, that's the way to go. We do have legislation here in the UK. We have the Animal Welfare Act. And it's very clear in Section 4, it says about unnecessary suffering. But we're not making enough of an argument to legislators that actually a shock collar is unnecessary suffering, actually. So that's something we've got to focus in on over the coming years, is about how we are better at lobbying. Obviously, you're very involved now, me less so, but with the UK Dog Behaviour and Training Charter. And I think we have to look at these different things in the future. But we've got to find a way of drawing a line in the sand on the basics from a legislative point of view. For many on the positive side, whatever that looks like probably wouldn't be enough. And I get that. But we have to start somewhere, because we have nothing other than the Animal Welfare Act and other than some of the kind of more general things that we have here in the UK. It's crazy that if I kicked a dog in the street, I could get done. But if I kicked a dog in the name of training, somehow that's okay. You know, if I was physical with a dog in the name of training. So something's not right there. So that's what I think we need to look at there.
You're absolutely right. You're right. And I hope that times are changing. I really do. And as the UK Dog Behaviour and Training Charter is looking into it, and I'm excited about that. I'm excited for VSA and VSPDT to be part of it. And we are discussing and growing all the time that things, that there will be change. There will be change. And that's why I cannot wait for your presentation at the Dog Behavior Conference. You'll have to come April the 19th to the 21st. Andy will be talking about bringing cake to dog training. And if you have just been fired up like I have by listening to Andy speak, well, there's more to come. So please register for the Dog Behavior Conference. It's dogbehaviorconference.com. And yeah, you're going to learn a ton more. I learn something from you each time I speak with you. I think what has just really resonated with me is you saying that, you know, because I hear it all the time, oh, I was smacked as a child and didn't do me any harm. When you say, well, yeah, I actually did, because you're thinking pain is okay. I was smacked as a child. I also had the ruler as a child on the hands as a nursery in nursery school. I will never forget that. But I've never thought it was okay. I didn't think it was okay then. It just made me pretend I was ill, so I didn't have to go to nursery school, for goodness sake. And it made me cry a lot. And I remember it to this day. I remember the little boy that was taken up at the top table during mealtime and made to bend over and whacked with a cane at age 5. I remember that clearly to this day. I remember smacks from my parents, and they just smacked me because they were great parents, but that's what they did because that's what everybody did. But I remember it, and I remember even thinking then, this is wrong. This is wrong. So, but I've heard those people say, yeah, I was smacked and I'm okay. And I guess I have turned out okay. But the trauma of that, the trauma as a young 4 to 5 year old child being thwacked on the hands with a ruler and seeing some kid up there humiliated and told to bend over on the top table and hit with a cane. I will never forget that. That is wrong. And then what you just said about, you know, of course, kids used to be hit with sticks. What happens if you're out there on the high street, the main street, and you kick a dog? That's wrong, but you can do it. It's on social media. We can see it. And these people are revered and followed. But they're kicking dogs all day. And they're hanging dogs and they're fighting with them to get the muzzle on. It is, and they're shocking them. But people say, that's okay. That excuse, my French, is fucked up. And it has to change. So those things that you've said, everything resonates with me, but those I think have really hit home, and that's why I'm fired up. But I don't want to end on this. I don't want to end on like a negative note, because I think there's a lot of positive in it too. That awareness, that light bulb moment, that's what this conference is all about. That's why you do what you do. That's why I do what I do. And we improve the world. We improve the world for dogs, and we improve the world for the people that love them. Am I right?
100%. And I think, you know, it's okay to get fired up. You know, we are all activists in our own way. And it's that activism, really, that's the key. And we find our purpose through that. And I think, things will get better. Even now, one thing to bear in mind, again, these people we see on social media, and they're often tens of thousands of people lauding them. There are hundreds of thousands of people who aren't, actually. And yes. I think this is the problem that we don't always see that thing. And I think the general public, it's really good to see. Obviously, we were hoping to get the shock collar ban done here in England, and because our government's a bit of a mess at the moment, it didn't quite happen, but I think it will, because there's enough support, mainly because every survey shows the general public are really supportive. And actually, you and I, we're in a bit of a bubble because we get involved with everything. it's amazing how many of my clients, the ones who aren't using ChocOz, of course, who are, when they see it on the my intake form, if you use these tools, they're like, what's a shock collar? And I tell them, is that even legal? You know, these are many voices that we have to connect to.
Yes.
The vast majority of people deeply care about their dogs. They just don't have enough understanding yet about the rich lived emotional and physical experience of their dog. When they do, they won't want this stuff and they will see it for what it is. They will see it for what it is. So, we make differences all the time, whether it's a dog at time or whether, you know, we have bigger platforms and we can influence more. But this is the conference all over, you know, it's asking these questions every year. You've created such an amazing vibe around the conference each year. And I think it's really special for that. It's a safe learning experience. It's also a safe space for us as speakers to think, I can talk about what I want to talk about here and not feel that I'm going to be kind of censored in some way. You know, we're going to ask the questions. We might not have the answers, Victoria, sometimes, and that's okay. But we just got to find those safe spaces with what we've created with the conference to ask them.
Andy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm so excited to hear your presentation. I love you to the ends of the earth and back again. Thank you for giving us the time now. And thanks to everybody who's listening. I knew this podcast was going to be amazing. He never disappoints. Thanks, guys, for listening. And we'll see you next time. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in to Victoria Stilwell's Positively Podcast. For Victoria's online dog training courses, more information, and helpful dog training tips, visit Victoria's official website at positively.com. Get connected on Facebook, Instagram, and other social media as Victoria Stilwell, and follow her on Twitter at Victoria S. Learn to become a professional dog trainer with the Victoria Stilwell Academy at vsdogtrainingacademy.com. And be sure to tune in next time as Victoria helps you and your dog live your best life together. Positively.